Welcome, everyone. Thanks for attending today. We'll go ahead and call the meeting to order and begin with introductions. Mark, are you going to call roll for us today?
I'll be glad to. All right. Dr. David Tudor.
Here.
Mr. Rob Vinke.
Here.
Dr. Lisa Bellner.
Here.
Dr. John Benitez. Dr. John Brophy.
Yo.
Dr. Richard Cole. Dr. Ceresia Cummings.
Here.
Ms. Lisa Hartman. Dr. Jeff Hazelwood.
Here.
Mr. Dan Hedrick.
Here.
Ms. Jenny Howard sent an email to Susie saying she was not going to be here. Dr. Greg Kaiser. Ms. Amy Moses. Dr. Wills Oglesby. Dr. Robert Snyder.
Here.
Ms. V. Story.
Here.
Dr. Jim Talmadge.
Here.
And Ms. Misty Williams.
Here.
All right, we do have enough for a quorum. It takes a third of the members for a quorum, and we have more than a third. So you are free to proceed, Dr. Tudor.
Thanks, Mark. Do we want to recognize the Bureau workers that are with us today?
Yes, we can. Okay. Amy, Mark, Amy Moses is on the call.
Mark? Oh, okay, thank you.
Okay, there she is. Okay.
All right, thank you.
Okay, Bureau employees, if you identify yourselves.
Roy Haley, administrator.
Susie Douglas.
Amanda Terry, Director of Legal Services.
Mark Finks, the staff attorney for the Bureau.
Okay.
Is that everybody? Good.
Okay.
And how about visitors?
Okay, visitors, if you would identify yourselves, please.
Hello, all. This is Tiffany Grabowski from Healthy Systems.
Thank you.
Larry Brinton with the Curo Solutions.
Spencer Nelson with MNA Government Relations.
Darian Scarantino Optum.
Alex O'Neill with Arbicare.
David Price with Preferred Medical.
Faith Parrish with Vanderbilt.
Mr. Beatty, I saw you're there as well.
Yarnell,
yes, hey, this is Jonathan
Medical May. Association.
And Mr. May?
Happy to be here, yes, for the people.
And on the telephone, 313 number.
V. Story, Zurich.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay.
Can you read those numbers?
Very good.
That's crazy. Well, welcome everyone. As Mark said, we do have a quorum. So we'll move on to approval of minutes for the last meeting, the June 6th meeting. Those were provided in an email last week. Any corrections, addendums, changes to the minutes? If If not, we'll take a motion to accept the minutes as written. Motion. Thanks, Dan. Do we have a second?
Second.
Thanks, Dr. Brophy. Any opposed? No, so we'll accept the minutes as written. And everyone's favorite form of the year, conflict of interest form, starts all over again today. So new fiscal year, new forms. So if that was also in the email from last week. So if everyone can complete the conflict of interest form. And I guess, Susie, did those come to you?
Yes, sir, please.
Okay. And send Thank those you. To Susie ASAP. Good deal. We'll move on into old business, the ODG update from August.
In your packet was the ODG update. Most of what was done was topic changes. There were some minor changes to the epidural corticosteroid update, which was probably the most consequential of the four pages of changes, where they removed references and made other changes to ultrasounds, and particularly to removing entries and cross references. So, any comments?
I didn't find it very much changed. So,
no,
there wasn't much there.
Hello there. Mark, Dr. Oglesby just walked in, so if you could count him on the present list.
Okay, will do.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right, we'll take an action. Do we have a motion to accept the ODG changes?
I'll make a motion to accept them.
Misty, thank you. Do we have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Dr. Oglesby. Any opposed? No. So we'll accept the ODG updates as written. Medical fee schedule update.
Due to the special session, the rules for medical fee schedule and certified physician were supposed to go to the Government Operations Committee on August the 28th, which was the start of the special session. The committee was canceled, and so those two issues have been moved to September 20th. The Government Operations Committee is going to meet in the afternoon in House Hearing Room Number 1. If there's anybody who wants to come to the Cordell Health Building and sit through the Government Operations Committee, they are quite welcome. We would welcome all of those, anybody who's interested in coming to help us.
Can you refresh our memory about what specifically they're addressing and how long that's been living?
Okay. The medical fee schedule was started in November of 2022. Okay. The certified physician program started in March of 2022, and so we're still awaiting both those activities to come before the Government Operations Committee. Now, according to the posting with the Secretary of State's office, the Certified Physician Program rules are effective September the 14th, and the medical fee schedule rules are effective September the, I believe it's the 21st. Pending a positive recommendation from the Government Operations Committee on those two rules. As far as the Certified Physician Program is concerned, when we go live will depend upon not only the Government Operations Committee, but also when we can activate the programs again, and those will be advertised on the website and to all of the physicians that have already started participation in that Certified Physician Program. So that will be occurring in October. So be prepared We don't really have a go-live date yet, but it's anticipated that we are hoping for November the 1st. But we were hoping for last July as well, so don't hold your breath and don't hold me to that specific date. The medical fee schedule update is pending. The rules essentially allow the administrator to adopt the rules. Okay? So the effective date of the medical fee schedule changes will not be announced until the administrator has a chance to review not only the Government Operations Committee, but also the implementation of the medical fee schedule. The reason for the hesitancy is that we are going to go to rate tables that are going to be published by Fair Health. Those rate tables will be made available to all providers and all payers free of charge. However, you will have to go to Fair Health site to get the download for that. It will be in a downloadable format, either in Excel, and should be available then long before they become effective. One of the problems with the present fee schedule being Medicare-based is that our fee schedule would go into effect January the 1st with the Medicare conversion factor at that time. The problem is that at least for the last 8 or 9 years, and maybe even before that, the changes that Medicare made in the cuts were then changed by Congress. And Congress then would specify that the cuts that Medicare had made would not be effective and would be retroactive to January the 1st of the year that the Congress reauthorized the Medicare conversion factor. The problem with that is that Medicare could go back and repay the providers and use their software to repay the providers. In workers' compensation, there are 300 payers, and it's almost impossible for the providers to go back and get reimbursed for each one, claim by claim, for the changes in Medicare. So as a result of that, the rate tables will go into effect April the 1st for an entire year. So it will be April the 1st of 2024 through March the 31st of 2025. And so there would not be any changes once that was put into effect. What this will do is stabilize those rates after Congress has made their final resolution of what the conversion factor would be. And so that's going to stabilize a lot of the complexity of billing under or billing using Medicare conversion factor in workers' compensation.
What company do we go to download again?
It'll be Fair Health. It'll be
Fair Health. Is it ready now or is it not?
No, it will not be ready. So it will not be ready until well after March the 1st because Congress usually does not do very much until they come back sometime in February. And so that's why we had to delay that to give Fair Health a chance to build into their software the conversion factor that Congress finally agreed to. Is that complicated enough?
Okay. This is why there are so many problems with figuring payments and getting those out to folks. It is a constant challenge and something that I get calls on at least weekly.
But this should make it better.
I hope so.
That's an answered prayer.
South Carolina and Georgia both use rate tables.
Okay.
Okay. So if anybody who does paying has Georgia workers' compensation or South Carolina workers' compensation, it's essentially the same format as those two states. The difference is that both Georgia and South Carolina require payment to Fair Health for those rate tables, okay, which will not be in Tennessee. It will be it's part of the agreement concerning the rate tables was that it would be available to providers and payers, and the Bureau will absorb those costs.
Nice. Very good. Very good.
Stay tuned. There will be a lot of flying emails and announcements once both of those programs are accepted by the administrator.
All right. We'll move ahead to the reward, the employer honor roll.
Susie?
Thank you. And first, I also want to announce that Dr. Cole was able to join us. He is on the 901 number on the call, so he has been with us for a few minutes.
And thank you, Dr. Cole.
Yes, welcome. And you're welcome. So with the reward program, I have talked to you all about the reward program for several meetings. And so the latest update, the newest update, is that we do have the reward employer honor roll application ready. We're very close to finishing a press release for that. And so we're going to promote that. We hope you all will promote this as well. This is a recognition program for employers who do exemplify the principles of the reward program. So we want to recognize those employers. We'll list them on our website. They will be recognized, and they will also be able to send someone to our conference, their return to work coordinator. We'll receive complimentary entrance to our annual conference, but it's much more than that. So having a good return to work program is something that's good for the employer and the employees, and we want them to be acknowledged for that. So the cutoff date is November 15th to apply. The application is online, and it's very easy to fill out and complete. The criteria is also online in our toolkit. If you have any questions, please let me know and refer any employers to me with any questions or interest. Thanks.
Thanks, Susie. Any questions or discussion? All right. We'll move on to legislative update. Amanda, do you have that for us?
I do. Thank you. And thank you to Dr. Snyder for carrying that heavy load on the rules. That was a lot. I appreciate the help. So one thing that we didn't mention is that the MIRR rulemaking hearing is on September the 18th, just for your knowledge, at 11 a.m. And also we have court rules and appeals board rules that are going through that are waiting on signatures from the Attorney General's office. As far as legislation update, you know, we've gotten our administrative proposal together, and we're in the process of getting it approved and things like that that have to be done before it can be put on the floor or anything like that. So looking ahead to 2024, we don't really have anything major planned for the Bureau on that. Medical cannabis may be a possibility. I haven't heard anything about that yet, but I'm sure, as you all know, that comes around frequently, if not every single year. We also have if it's okay, I'll go on to the October the 19th GovOps hearing, and that is going to be scheduled for House Hearing Room 1 is where it will be held, and that's just where the activities of state agencies and organizations, they are reviewed at least once every 8 years. So, but other than that, it's we're just getting it rolling and working towards having a good 2024 proposal. So,
thanks, Amanda.
The Medical Advisory Committee is part of the sunset hearing on October the 19th. So that's why it's on our agenda.
Is that 6 years ago? Or
yes.
Was that 8 years ago?
I don't recall whether it was six or eight.
Then it's been eight. It's been a while.
I think it's been right at eight.
8 years.
Yeah, we got a 6-year extension in 2017 in the legislative session. So we've got, or 2018. So we had our sunset audit in 2017. Got a 6-year extension in 2018, and so that is coming up. And there was no formal audit this time from the comptroller because we had such a good audit last time and got such a long extension. So, but there are a list of questions that the comptroller has sent to me and to Dr. Snyder and Susie to answer on each of the three sunsets, the MAC, the MPC, and the Bureau itself. So we'll be working on that. But that's correct. August is the joint subcommittee for sunset, and we'll keep working on those questions until that time.
Again, anyone is invited to come to sunset hearing, House Hearing Room 1.
It was interesting last time.
October the 19th.
Yeah.
And I believe that's in the morning. I think that's at 9 a.m. The September the 20th meeting for the medical fee schedule is in the afternoon. That's at 1 o'clock. So if you have any questions and if you're interested, come join.
For the medical fee schedule, repeat that day.
That is September the 20th.
At 1 p.m.
Yeah.
So I guess the big question, should we have any concerns?
You never know.
That's what makes it so fun and exciting.
Right. Very good. Thanks. Move on to utilization review.
We sent 5 violations of the utilization review rules to the penalty program. 2 of them were for records violations. The other 3 were various things like unlicensed Tennessee physician doing a UR. So there were 5 during this since the last meeting.
And any questions or discussion on UR? I'm always just kind of curious how this is being licensed in multiple states. That's usually the first thing I look at before I complete a form for that state.
Right.
So that's fairly blatant then.
Yes.
Yes.
They have to be careful.
Yeah. So, all right, we'll move on to COVID update.
In your packet of information was an analysis of long COVID. What we did, WCRI came out with a analysis of long COVID for the period of time from 9/20 to 9/21. So it was a year, but remember, this is a year before. And so we took the analysis of what had been reported to the Bureau and then compared that to what we have from the national average of WCRI. And so during that period of time, that one-year period of time, so remember, this is from before vaccine to start of the vaccine, okay? So it was that period of time in the summer of 20, from the fall of 20 through the summer of 2021. There were 5,500 Tennessee claims filed during that period of time, of which there were 994 claims paid, okay? So this WCRI data comes from paid claims, okay? So it's a good index of what was accepted as a COVID claim that was reported to the insurance company and how they paid those. And so of those 994 claims, 67% of them were indemnity only. So these were for paid time off and not an accepted as COVID claims, but did not require any medical treatment. So this was 2 weeks at home quarantine time that was covered by workers' comp during that period of time. Interestingly, only 18% was medical only, and 14% with both, and there are 1% fatalities. 10% of the Tennessee claims qualified as long COVID, which was higher than the national average of 6%. And of those 10% of the claims, 59%, or almost 60% of them, were patients that had been in the ICU. Okay. So they were accepted as long COVID claims. Now, the diagnosis of long COVID or the acceptance of long COVID varies depending upon whether you're talking about the WHO criteria or whether you're talking about the CDC criteria. And so the difference is WHO, I believe, has to be 3 months. The CDC has accepted symptoms after 1 month post illness. But most of these, as you can see, a large majority of these were in post-ICU patients, so they still had symptoms either between 1 and 3 months or longer than 3 months after their hospitalization. So I don't think that that's a surprising statistic. I mean, post-ICU syndromes for all patients is relatively common, especially in even other post-viral cases of ICU, ARDS and so on are quite common. Average total medical cost for an accepted claim was $29,000, ranging from $190,000 in ICU patients to $4,000 in those that had received no acute care but yet were accepted claims as long COVID. Indemnity benefits averaged $14,000. Almost two-thirds of the body systems involved were lung, but 42%, obviously a lot of them had more than one symptom or one body system involved. And 7% had four or more body systems involved, and the duration of the symptoms was 52 weeks. So these were patients that had been accepted long claims from the beginning of COVID and were still having symptoms a year later. Inpatient treatment included 22% of medical payments in the post-acute period, and 31% of the services included counseling and mental health. And then finally, what was interesting was the breakdown in where these claims came from. So 30% was facility living employees, that is nursing home and domiciliary care. 27% were hospital. 11% were medical offices. So very high percentage then was directly related to medical care or living facilities. So I thought it was an interesting follow-up on what's happening in COVID, what we're seeing with payments. There have been very, very few COVID claims filed with the Bureau since June, since our last meeting, and almost none have been accepted as compensable. We did have one. There is one long COVID claim, which is being adjudicated at the present time in mediation. And so that's all we have. Virtually no court cases. There are a couple fatalities, but we've seen very little action when it comes to Bureau activity as it has to do with disputes over COVID.
Sounds like Jeff may have a few claims coming out of his office for COVID soon.
Watch your mouth.
Sorry. So the indemnity, so for the payments that were for, I guess, isolation or quarantine, either post-exposure or post-illness, were those numbers paid by workers' comp? Or does that include the, like, employer's pay? Because I know a lot of employers just adopted policies and just direct paid employees.
This was all data that was reported to WCRI as paid claims under workers' compensation.
Okay.
Okay.
I believe there were a lot of third-party administrators that were paying a lot of claims.
Okay. So did you guys pay a lot as travelers?
A lot.
Yeah. Okay.
That does not include the hospital systems that covered their quarantine costs, just covering them as part of their benefits package.
Yeah.
Have you guys had any MIRR cases on COVID ratings or not, Bob?
No, none.
Yeah, I've done about four impairment ratings on pulmonary cases, but just four, I think, total.
You mean we're going to start to see four cases? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, since I did, I'm probably yes. But they were all pulmonary and pretty straightforward cases.
Interesting. So, any other discussion around COVID? If not, we'll move on to sleep apnea. And Dr. Hazelwood going to cover that for us today?
Well, I put this in at Dr. Hazelwood's suggestion last Friday. This is the in your packet was given the chronic opioid, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine position statement concerning opioids and sleep apnea evaluation. And so they strongly suggest that anyone on opioids have a sleep apnea evaluation. And so I included the Ohio Sleep Medicine Stop Bang sleep apnea questionnaire. So this is used in the hospitals for pre-anesthesia evaluations, but also this is something that you should be aware of in your practice as to individuals that might require evaluation for sleep apnea. Sleep apnea does cause a lot of health problems, including hypertension medication use for poor sleep when it's actually making it worse. So I included this because it gives everyone background information for those individuals that are on narcotics when they should get an evaluation. Any comments, Dr. Hazelwood?
Yeah, you know, again, the CDC guidelines doesn't say don't use opioids. It just says when possible, avoid them. So it leaves a little room for interpretation, obviously. But what I'm trying to do now is pretty much have the patient sign a statement that they understand the risk present, that they communicate this situation with their primary care physician, and ideally get referred to a sleep specialist. We're not seeing a whole lot else happen. I think a big problem is nobody can afford a sleep study if they don't have insurance. So what do you do with that situation? I think another emphasis in the CDC guidelines is close monitoring. So even on my low risk patients on less than 40 milligrams morphine a day, I feel like I have to see them back monthly. If they're not on CPAP, if they're on CPAP, I pretty much do bi-monthly. But I think it just comes down to documentation, explaining the risk, assessing whether the benefits obviously outweigh the risk. And I don't know what else to do. From what I hear from IME patients and other patients, pain clinics don't seem to be even addressing it across the board. Very few seem to be doing that. So, I'm getting less strict on stopping them. I just don't think that's fair. But if they're on CPAP, they understand the risk. They're none of mine on high dose anyway. That's about the best I know to do. And I just don't know what else to do. But CDC doesn't say stop it. It just says try to avoid. So it leaves room there, obviously. But I think it is a definite concern, especially in the setting of polypharmacy. And it's just scary to me, but I don't know what else, I don't know how else to handle it than what I just said.
What do you think the compliance rate is with CPAP, even if they have it?
That's a good question. I'd say, I think my patients probably 70-80%. I think a few are not. I've got a lot that just use oxygen, and they've been told that that's good enough, but that doesn't quite make sense to me. But, you know, I've got a few that come back with a statement from the pulmonary specialist stating that it was only mild sleep apnea. So I think it's these severe and moderate severe cases that are much more dangerous, obviously. But at least I'm trying to get documentation, if possible, from the sleep specialist. And I've had a few that updated their sleep study, and they made adjustments in the CPAP. So who knows? Maybe we are saving a few lives there. But it's just awfully hard to get people to comply. But I've been shocked how many people in Tennessee, number one, have sleep apnea, and number two, how many people are not using CPAP and never were. They were told to use it, but the last 3 or 4 years, they said, I couldn't tolerate it, so I just quit using it. And I'm not even sure their primary care physicians know that. So at least it brings in the opportunity to discuss this and make them aware of the danger, if nothing else.
So, Misty, would if that scenario was under workers' comp, would travelers pay for a polysomnogram or
generally that's not covered because it's considered an unrelated medical diagnosis.
Okay.
That's brought in after the claim's already settled and taken care of. And I don't know that there's anything that I saw in that particular article that specifically said that, you know, narcotics led to, or the use of narcotics that they're using for pain would lead to sleep apnea, but could be complicated by sleep apnea.
So would their Blue Cross pay for the?
It would need to be private medical.
They do. Yep. Okay.
But Jim, isn't it? And doesn't the research shows that the opioids actually can cause central sleep apnea and even obstructive sleep apnea? I thought, is that correct or not?
You have obstructive sleep apnea. Opioids can make it worse, but opioids can de novo cause central sleep apnea that did not appear on your polysomnogram before you started opioids. And if you have central sleep apnea, standard CPAP is useless. You've got to breathe in order for CPAP to assist you.
So right.
People who die in bed overnight are probably central sleep apnea. You can put oxygen in the room, but if you don't breathe, it does not get into your lungs.
So I always list as some risk factors for opioids. I include sleep apnea as a risk factor, correct?
Yeah. It can make obstructive worse, and it can cause de novo central sleep apnea.
Right.
And then the problem comes becoming, you know, you can't get testing before they started narcotics, so you're not going to have anything to compare that against to be able to say this definitively caused.
Right.
So that puts that pressure on the physician again to give an opinion.
Right. And if they can't afford their sleep study, they can't afford CPAP either. So that's another problem.
Right.
Yeah. And it's not a unique problem. You've got people with a hemoglobin A1C of 13 who want a joint replacement, or a BMI of 45 who want a joint replacement, or an unstable angina, need a whatever, where more pressing medical general conditions are present that complicate receiving care for your work injury.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the biggest things that stretches out recovery time, is their comorbidities.
Another interesting point I saw in that paper was that opioids, actually low-dose opioids, can be used to successfully treat restless leg syndrome. I never had seen that before.
Consider your source. That's only one opinion.
And it's right.
Statements. It's not backed up by references.
Okay.
But nobody dies with restless leg syndrome. Well, you can die with it, but you don't die from it.
Well, that's what I tell patients that need to come off. Pain cannot kill you. Typically, opioids can. And I think that's a fair statement.
Right.
Any other discussion there? If not, we'll move on to new business. I'm curious about our first topic.
There is some crossover or some blending of occupational medicine activities in clinics with case management. The Bureau has, we've been trying to understand how occupational medicine clinics operate when it comes to interactions with the providers. And so if anybody has any ideas about when it would be when an occupational health nurse would be overstepping their bounds when it comes to interactions with physicians or with the treating of their injured workers, their employees. We would like your opinions. We're not making any accusations against anybody, but we're just researching just how occupational clinic medicine clinics work when it comes to the treatment of their injured workers, their employees. So
you're referring to on-site occupational
correct.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And assuming that the occupational health nurse isn't a certified case manager.
Well,
right.
We don't want to make the employers think that they have to have case management every time an occupational medicine clinic sends their employees, injured workers, to a physician. That's not what we're going at. What we're just asking is how it operates.
Right.
Because obviously I'm not there. So I don't know what happens when an employee comes in and complains that, you know, I injured my shoulder when I slipped and fell on the floor. You know, what happens? What's the next step? How does the occupational medicine clinic then operate with potential workers' compensation injuries? That's all we're asking. So,
does that mean that there are concerns that they are treating within the employer directly with no reporting or oversight to workers' compensation system?
We have no idea. Okay. Are those injuries getting reported to the insurers? So, that's why we're just asking questions. So if anybody has any insight into those, we'd like to hear from you.
Yes and no to all of the above.
Come on now. Come on now. Definitely has insight to
it. It depends on the clinic, really. Every clinic operates a little differently. And,
The challenge for us is to make sure we're staying within first aid guidelines. That means you report it.
Mm-hmm.
You may not receive medical treatment as OSHA defines it, but you report it. And that's the best, that's the optimal thing that helps us. It's reported. We may be seeing them as somebody who's doing wellness exercises, paving, job coaching, on site kind of thing. Okay. They're with them, but none of those are recorded things. But you want it to be reported in case it progresses.
You're saying
it
first report, is that what you're saying, when reported?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if I'm saying that or not. I'm saying first aid guidelines with OSHA. I want to make sure I'm staying within first aid guidelines if I'm meeting a client on site for a it's been reported within the employer, but it needs to be reported to the workers' comp insurance at the same time. Both of those things need to occur. And so my treatment would be first aid. That's what I would be providing up there as a PT.
And those are considered like report only claims and because there's different levels. There's report only claims and those are claims that are called in and say, well, they're really not getting any treatment or they're getting a Band-Aid, but they're okay, but I wanted to report it. And then there's another level up where, oh, we just went to the OCC health clinic, we got stitches and we're done, or maybe it's even further and it needs to be managed more.
That's right. And there's times when it comes to us when there's not somebody like you all on site, I'm like, oh, I can't do anything about that.
Right.
It needs to go on.
Right.
We need to go to the panel, whatever panel you got.
Correct.
So that's my experience with it. As far as interaction with an occupational health nurse within cases, we have interactions with those all the time because we're talking about restrictions, your restrictions for the patient, and they want to know how to implement those. And if they know us, they're calling us and we'll help them with that. That's our interaction with an occupational health nurse when somebody's injured. I don't know if that's what you're asking.
We just want to know, you know.
Yeah. And some of them act like case managers. Some of them manage them internally.
Yeah.
Some of them know their employees well enough, they will manage their cases internally. And even after it goes
and they
on,
have some
workers
some even go to the panel doctors with them.
It depends on where you're at.
As a nurse from the site. And,
yep.
I think we're typically there to help give our two cents worth, you know, on what we feel like is appropriate and not appropriate for them to do. But ultimately, it comes down typically to the employer and how they manage their clinic.
We're interested in just asking the question. So any input you have, put it in writing and send it to us.
Anything else there? Or we'll move on to PC 0300.
Okay, the legislature passed public chapter 300, which requires a governing body of any kind to have reasonable public notice and also to have an announcement as to public comments. Okay. I sent out which was the preliminary with the public chapter. But what we're asking for the committee is a change that would allow either requests be made either by email or by telephone at least one business day in advance of the meeting instead of 1 hour. That's what was proposed or what was original. Okay, and so that the chair during the meetings will entertain public comments. Either by verbal request, physical or virtual hand raised, or request via Teams chat, but the chair reserves the prerogative to limit the length of comment and its relevance to the subject under discussion. So we will, with the acceptance of the committee, we will put that in the notice of each public notice for each meeting. So I'm asking the committee to approve that.
Okay. Any discussion? If no discussion, we can take a motion to accept that. And that's the statement as was printed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dan, thank you. First, do we have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Any opposed? No. All right. We'll put that in the notice. point. So any other new business for today or announcements?
Well, I have one.
Okay.
No meeting would be complete at this time without talking about AI. So the reason I toss that out is that the American Medical Association Journal has issued very strong guidance concerning research activities that have to do with using AI in research. Unless the project itself is the subject is AI, they are significantly discouraging any use of AI in data analysis and also in fashioning manuscripts. So, a very strong word. The reason I bring this up is that we have investigated the possibility in utilization review of using, actually it would have been GPT-3 in evaluating our medical records. It turns out that all of these AI models do not have protected health information vendor agreements with other individuals, other companies, other entities that are holding protected health information. And so just be aware that if you are using any of these tools, that you may be running afoul of the HIPAA concerning protected health information. So I just bring that to the attention of everybody, that unless you have a vendor agreement that using or putting any of that information in any form that would go to ChatGPT, to OpenAI, to any of the other ones, unless there's a vendor agreement about protected health information, be very careful that all of your activities, all of your documents are internal or with organizations that have vendor agreements.
That's good to know.
I thought it was important for everybody just to be aware that this time, you know, medical records and the chatbots do not have vendor protected health information agreement.
Any other new business or announcements? If not, I guess we'll look toward our next meeting on December 5th. And be ready to adjourn.
Anybody else have anything else?
I guess we need 5 more minutes, but no, that's okay. All right, we'll go ahead and adjourn. Thanks, everyone, and look forward to seeing you in December.